The Katra Podcast Conversations for the Curious Essential Knowledge Simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of a Katra AI. Welcome, everyone, to a deep dive. Today, we're wrestling with some really big philosophical questions. You know, the kind that make you question everything you thought was solid ground.
Yeah, we're tackling David Hume, a huge figure from the 18th century. His skepticism really shook things up, paving the way for modern science, modern philosophy.
But we're doing it through a specific, very sharp lens. 20th century British philosopher A.J. Ayer.
That's right. Ayer wrote this fantastic little book on Hume, and it's kind of the perfect way in.
So our mission today, give you a shortcut to understanding Ayer's take on Hume. And why does this matter now? Well, Ayer really highlights how Hume wasn't just tearing things down. He was building a method, a way to see the limits of our own reason.
Exactly. And in a world just flooded with information, claims, counterclaims, understanding this is, well, it's crucial. It gives you tools. Intellectual humility, yes, but also a filter for what's verifiable versus what's maybe just noise.
Okay, let's unpack Ayer himself a bit first. A.J. Ayer lived 1910 to 1989. Big name in British philosophy, especially known for leading this movement called logical positivism.
And that context is absolutely vital. Logical positivism basically argued that for a statement to be meaningful, truly meaningful, it has to be verifiable, either through logic, like, you know, math is, or through actual sensory experience like science.
Anything else? Metaphysics, theology.
According to the strict logical positivists, like Ayer, literally nonsense, meaningless sounds. It sounds harsh, I know.
It does sound quite severe.
It is. But you see, this ties directly back to Hume. Ayer saw Hume as an intellectual ancestor. He shared that deep suspicion of abstract ideas you can't pin down, that commitment to grounding knowledge in what we can actually experience.
Ah, okay. So Hume laid the groundwork with this empiricism knowledge from experience, and Ayer, centuries later, picked it up, refined it with modern logic, and really ran with it.
Precisely. So Ayer isn't just explaining Hume, he's interpreting him with this analytical intensity, but also with real sympathy. He's bridging Hume's 18th century world with the 20th century's focus on science and language.
He gets what Hume was trying to achieve, not just destruction, but a kind of philosophical house cleaning.
Yeah, replacing shaky old justifications with something more solid, psychologically real, empirically grounded.
So what's the big picture of Hume's project, according to Ayer?
Ayer frames Hume as this really constructive innovator. Hume wanted to create a science of human nature, and his main tool, radical empiricism.
Radical empiricism. Meaning all knowledge has to come from experience, from our senses.
Exclusively. Yeah. That's the radical part. No innate ideas, no pure reason giving us truths about the world. Hume took this idea like a razor and just systematically applied it to God, to cause and effect, to the outside world, even to our idea of ourself.
And applying that razor just dismantled centuries of assumptions about certainty, didn't it?
Completely. It led him to some profoundly skeptical conclusions about things we take for granted. But here's the really interesting part, the part Ayer stresses. Hume didn't stop there.
Right. He didn't just leave us hanging in doubt.
No. When he showed that reason couldn't justify a core belief, like, say, believing that the sun will rise tomorrow just because it always has, he didn't say, so give up. He looked for a different explanation.
And found it in psychology.
Exactly. In human psychology, in habit, in custom, in our feelings and sentiments. He replaced the missing logical proof with a naturalistic explanation of why we believe these things.
Which leads to this idea Ayer calls mitigated skepticism.
Yes. It's not extreme paralyzing doubt. It's acknowledging, okay, reason has limits. We can't have absolute certainty about the world, but we still need to live, right? So we rely on these practical beliefs, these customs, these habits. It's about being intellectually honest, but also practical.
Okay, let's dive deeper. The foundations. Hume's epistemology. Where does he start?
He starts by looking at the contents of our minds, what's actually in there. He calls all mental content perceptions, and then makes this absolutely crucial distinction between impressions and ideas.
Impressions. Those are the direct, vivid things.
Right. The raw data. The immediate feeling of warmth from the sun, the actual sight of the color red, the sting of pain, they hit you with force.
And ideas are fainter.
Much fainter. They're copies of impressions. When you remember the warmth or think about red or imagine the pain, that's an idea. It's always derived from, and less lively than, the original impression.
Okay, simple enough distinction, but then he does something huge with it.
He does. This is the copy principle. Hume lays it down as a test. Every single meaningful idea you have must ultimately be traceable back to some original sensory impression or combination of impressions.
So if you have some grand philosophical concept like substance or perfect justice,
and you can't point to the specific impressions it came from, Hume says it's empty, meaningless chatter. It's his philosophical razor and it cuts deep.
Wow. That clears out a lot of old philosophy shelves. And this leads to another famous distinction, right? Hume's fork.
Yep. He divides all human knowledge, or potential knowledge, into two categories. On one side, you have relations of ideas.
Like math, geometry.
Exactly. Things like a triangle has three sides, or 5 + 7 = 12. These are certain. They're true by definition. We know them a priori just by thinking, but...
But they don't actually tell us anything about the world out there, just about how our ideas relate to each other.
Precisely. Then on the other side of the fork, you have matters of fact.
This is pretty much everything else, right?
Yeah.
Stuff about the world.
Yes. The sun is shining, grass is green, water boils at 100 degrees Celsius. These are based entirely on experience, a posteriori. We have to observe the world to know them.
And the key thing here is they're never absolutely certain.
Never. Because the opposite is always conceivable, logically possible. The sun could not rise tomorrow. Grass could, hypothetically, be blue somewhere. Science operates entirely in this realm of matters of fact, building knowledge based on observation, but always open to revision. Never absolute logical certainty.
Okay, that sets the stage. Now let's get to maybe his most famous critique, causation. Cause and effect.
Right. We all have this incredibly strong intuition, don't we? When A causes B, there's some kind of necessary connection, a power in A that makes B happen.
Like flicking a switch makes the light come on. There's a force, a necessity there.
Or so we think. Hume asks his killer empirical question. Show me the impression. Did you ever actually observe this necessary connection, this power?
Uh-oh. I see where this is going.
Exactly. As Ayer really emphasizes, Hume says, no, you didn't. What you observe is constant conjunction. You see event A, flicking the switch. Then you see event B, light comes on. Repeatedly, reliably. One follows the other.
But you never see the necessity itself.
Yeah.
The invisible force linking them.
Never. So Hume concludes, that feeling of necessity isn't in the objects or events. It's in our minds. It's a psychological expectation we develop. A habit or custom. After seeing A followed by B enough times, our mind just automatically expects B when it sees A again.
So causation isn't a feature of the world. It's a projection of our own minds.
Mm-hmm.
A really useful one, obviously, but still.
A projection based on habit. Powerful, indispensable for survival and science, but ultimately rooted in psychology, not objective reality.
But wait, if cause and effect is just habit, how does science even work? Isn't science all about finding causal laws to predict the future?
It is. And this leads directly into the famous problem of induction. Hume points out something deeply unsettling. Our assumption that the future will resemble the past. Well, it can't be rationally justified.
How so?
Think about it. Why do we believe the laws of physics will hold true tomorrow? Because they held true yesterday and the day before.
Yeah, it seems reasonable.
But using past experience to justify predictions about the future assumes the very principle you're trying to prove. You're assuming the future will be like the past in order to argue that the future will be like the past. It's circular reasoning.
Wow. Okay. So induction, the foundation of all empirical science and everyday prediction,
mm-hmm.
It's not based on logic.
Not on deductive, airtight logic, no. According to Hume, it's a fundamental instinctual habit, a brute fact about how our minds work, essential for survival. We have to assume the future will resemble the past to function, but we can't prove it logically. That's mitigated skepticism in action.
This is relentless skepticism. Does he turn the same sharp eye inward on ourselves?
Oh, absolutely. He takes on personal identity. We tend to think of ourselves as having this continuous, unchanging self or soul that persists through time.
Right. The me that was here yesterday is the same me today.
Hume says, okay, let's apply the empirical test. Look inward. Try to find the single, simple, unchanging self. What do you actually find?
Well, thoughts, feelings, sensations, memories.
Exactly. A constant stream, a flux of different perceptions. One thought replaces another, one feeling fades and another arises. Hume says he can never catch this self existing apart from these perceptions.
So what is the self then?
He famously concludes it's nothing but a bundle or collection of different perceptions, succeeding each other with incredible rapidity, the feeling of a unified, continuous self. That's something our imagination constructs. It links perceptions together through resemblance and memory, creating a kind of narrative thread, A useful fiction, as Ayer puts it.
A useful fiction. Wow. And does this skepticism extend to the world outside us too? The external world?
It does, following the same logic. We only ever directly experience our own impressions, colors, sounds, textures. We never directly experience the thing itself, the object existing independently out there that supposedly causes those impressions.
So my belief that this desk continues to exist when I'm not looking at it
is technically an inference, an assumption. A very strong one, based on the consistency and coherence of our impressions. The desk usually looks the same each time, but still not something we directly perceive. It's another kind of useful belief generated by the mind.
Okay, we've hit reality, knowledge, the self. What about how we act? Morality.
Yeah.
Motivation.
Yes. This brings us to one of Hume's most famous and controversial lines. Reason is, and ought only to be, the slave of the passions.
That sounds pretty radical. Reason is the slave.
Ayer helps clarify this. Hume isn't dissing reason. He's saying reason is incredibly powerful, but its role is instrumental. It's the servant. It's brilliant at figuring out how to get what you want, calculating consequences, finding the best means to an end.
But it doesn't set the goals.
No. The passions are feelings, sentiments, desires. They are the master. They determine the ends. They provide the motivation. You don't decide to pursue justice because of a purely logical deduction. You pursue it because you feel injustice is wrong. You desire fairness. Reason helps you figure out how to achieve that goal.
So this forms the basis of his sentimentalist theory of morality.
Precisely. Moral judgments aren't discoveries of objective truths out there in the universe, like mathematical theorems. When we say something is good or virtuous, we're expressing a feeling, a sentiment of approval. When we say it's bad or vicious, we express disapproval.
And where do these feelings come from?
Hume argues they're rooted in our shared human nature, particularly our capacity for sympathy, our ability to feel pleasure at others' happiness and pain at their suffering. Morality arises from these natural shared feelings.
Which leads to another huge point in ethics.
Yeah.
The is-ought problem.
Yes. Hume pointed out this fundamental logical gap. You can describe how things are, matters of fact, but you can't logically leap from that description to a prescription of how things ought to be, values.
Example.
You can observe that society is competitive, that's an is statement, but you cannot, through logic alone, derive from that fact that people ought to act selfishly. There's a missing step, a value judgment that reason itself can't supply. That gap is still debated constantly in ethics.
Okay, let's pull back a bit. What are the big takeaways, the key themes Ayer emphasizes in Hume that really stick with us?
I think theme one has to be the limits of reason. Hume brilliantly used reason to map its own boundaries. It forces intellectual humility, showing a certainty is often impossible, especially in complex real-world matters.
Yeah, challenging that enlightenment ideal of reason conquering everything. Second theme.
Definitely the primacy of experience. Ayer really drums this home. Hume's insistence on grounding knowledge in observation, in empirical data, it's the philosophical bedrock of the scientific method. It helps you sort meaningful claims from, well, waffle.
Third.
I'd say naturalistic explanation and psychology. Hume consistently tried to explain why humans believe and behave as they do in morals, politics, knowledge, by looking at our actual psychology, our habits, our social needs. Not abstract rules from nowhere. It anticipates so much in modern cognitive science. He wanted to understand how we actually work.
And the final theme, circling back.
Mitigated skepticism, that essential balance. Acknowledge the limits, except we work with probabilities, not certainties, but don't fall into despair. Act based on those well-established customs and habits. It avoids both rigid dogmatism and crippling doubt. It's practical wisdom.
Hume's ideas are so potent and often summed up in these incredibly punchy quotes. Let's touch on a few.
Definitely. We already mentioned it, but it bears repeating. Reason is and ought only to be the slave of the passions. It's such a vital reminder. Logic serves our goals, but our feelings set those goals.
Then there's the explanation for why we rely on induction. Custom, then, is the great guide of human life. It grounds our predictions in scientific inquiry, not in absolute proof, but in this fundamental evolved habit. Practical, necessary, but still a habit.
And maybe the ultimate rule for critical thinking, often paraphrased from his work on miracles, quote, a wise man proportions his belief to the evidence. That's the maxim. Extraordinary claims demand extraordinary proof. Apply that everywhere, to news, to history, to personal beliefs.
So how can we apply these Humean insights via Ayer in our daily lives?
Well, critical thinking is the obvious one. Use Hume's fork. When you hear a claim, ask, is this a relation of ideas? true by definition, like math? Or is it a matter of fact based on observation, like a scientific finding or a news report? If it's the latter, remember it's probabilistic, not certain. Be skeptical of anyone claiming absolute certainty about complex future events, like market predictions.
And the reason is the slave of the passion's insight.
Huge for emotional intelligence and persuasion. If you want to connect with people, lead effectively, or just persuade someone, pure logic often isn't enough. You need to understand and appeal to their underlying feelings, values, desires. Connect on that level first.
What about the bundle theory of the self? That sounds potentially disturbing, but maybe useful.
It can be incredibly liberating for personal identity. If there's no fixed, unchanging core self, then you aren't trapped by who you were yesterday. The self is a process, always changing, always evolving based on new experiences and perceptions. It allows for growth, change, and less self-criticism about not living up to some imaginary fixed ideal. You are change.
Thinking through all this, what was most surprising for you in revisiting Hume through Ayer's lens?
For me, it's how skepticism, which sounds so negative, actually leads Hume, and Ayer shows this beautifully, not to nihilism or despair, but to this really grounded, pragmatic, almost optimistic view. We can build science, ethics, society, all on this foundation of experience and habit, even while acknowledging we don't have divine certainty. It's psychologically realistic and deeply practical.
Yeah, I agree. And what I loved most, I think, was Ayer driving home how intellectual humility and effective thinking go hand in hand. By recognizing reason's limits, by embracing that mitigated skepticism, you don't become weaker. You become a clearer, more realistic, and ultimately more effective thinker in the real world. That feels incredibly relevant right now.
Couldn't agree more.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Ekatra Foundation.